So if our three guests, Dr. Newman and Dr. Bloom, Dr. Phillips, will join me in the front, we'll entertain questions, some that you've had for a long time, perhaps some that will be prompted in our discussion.
We have probes out in outer space at the present time looking for other humans or other types of life. What are the probabilities that this theory that you just gone through could be taking place?
What's the probability that this process is taking place at other locations in the galaxy? I would say relatively high. It turns out that probably a good number of the stars, I couldn't give you a figure offhand, but a good number of the stars probably have planetary systems associated with them. And so I don't feel we are by any means the only solar system. In fact, the one picture that I had shows a disk around another star. We know that Vega has materials that are rotating around it, around the star. And so I would say the phenomenon of solar systems, of other solar systems, is really relatively high. But it would be another question to say that these solar systems have life on them. That is an entirely different question. But calculations show that in the galaxy as it is, probably about one star out of every, well, anywhere between 10 million and 10 billion could have a planet like the Earth around it. And what that boils down to is anywhere between about 40,000 and 4 million planets like the Earth someplace in our galaxy. So again, that's not to say there are 40,000 to 4 million living beings like ourselves in the galaxy. This is just, again, a probability calculation that there are Earth-like planets in the galaxy.
That obviously depends in detail on what you define as Earth-like planets. How are you trying to look?
Basically, by an Earth-like planet, I mean a planet that over the course of, well, 3 billion years, if you want to go that far, 3.5 billion years can support life as the Earth has been able to support life for that long. Not humans, but some form of life. And we feel that life certainly began on Earth, certainly has been around on Earth, that in terms of simpler microbes, dated back over 3 billion years ago, and conditions on Earth had to be such that those microbes and succeeding life could also exist on Earth. And that's what I mean by an Earth-like planet, one that could sustain life for that period of time. And there's where you come with the 40,000 to about 4 million planets.
We're talking a certain type of star that's got enough energy output that photosynthesis,
right,
something could function on it. It's stable enough that the temperature stays within bounds where water doesn't either boil or freeze, but between those boundaries. The size small enough that it doesn't have too much atmosphere around it so that you get huge greenhouse effects. Large enough that it's got enough atmosphere around it that you get somewhere near atmospheric pressure. You've got, well, for microbes, you have oxygen. But so there's a whole list of things, and that means about every minute. But this is not dealing at all with the question of, did life start there, which requires a solution to the question, how does life start? And our suggestion is, by God. And so then it depends on the decision that you decide to put into it. Okay, an evolutionist would say, oh, well, it starts by itself, but then they'd have to answer the question, how frequently does it start by itself? And nobody knows the answer to that. Okay. Well, a lot of people quote that, but they have numbers by a factor of 10 to the 100 or something. Depending on what you're talking about here. Oil on one end or saving on the other. So, quite a large difference.
I have two questions, if I may, please. Could you explain the Big Bang Theory and how its relation to the Bible, and also how you come about the age of the Earth?
Okay, Big Bang Theory is a model for the whole universe, not for questions of solar system, etc. Big Bang Theory has several varieties, but they all agree that there was an incident, let's say 10 to 20 billion years ago, maybe 17 billion years ago, in which the universe was at very, very high temperature and pressure, perhaps far higher temperature and pressure than anything existing in the universe at the present time, even black hole water. that it has been cooling down from that since that time, and that about a few thousand years after the Big Bang, the universe switched from being opaque, almost all brilliant light everywhere, to being transparent. And the remains of that transformation are what we call the fireball of the Big Bang. And that is still observable today, not as a fireball, but observable as a slight radiation from all directions that radio telescopes can pick up. The sky, so to speak, for a radio telescope is gray in all directions rather than black because of this material there. And the temperature of that is very close to what one astronomer had guessed it would be 20 or 30 years before that on the basis of a Big Bang model universe. Well, Big Bang model universe is very high density at some point in the past. Now, there are several varieties. The kind of thing you'd see in Sagan's Cosmos or in Asimov's material or something like that is that was just a contraction of the universe. And the universe expands and contracts every 100 billion years. And that was just the last one. And so you get Sagan saying things like, well, computers really figured this out earlier, etc. If you read through his Cosmos book or listened to his or watched the series, you see that Christianity generally comes out bad and any other religion comes out pretty good. However, the evidence we've got, although points to some kind of Big Bang, I think, seems to point to an absolute beginning at the Big Bang, rather than that was the collapse of the universe which expands, and a strong movement in that direction in just the last 5 years. The universe came into existence. That was just one stage in an infinite history. God of some sort, not happy about that. About the only alternative at the moment, though, is to suppose that somehow the universe consisted of a quantum vacuum forever, and it just fluctuated and produced the universe 20 billion years ago, 17 billion years ago, which is all trying to suggest tomorrow in our inanimate design discussion. It doesn't make any sense to design any design. It's a universe without any explanation. It's something that's astronomically unlikely, where we've got some pretty good evidence. When we look at the order, a Christian model, in which the mind makes sense of the order, that's something likely, something terribly unlikely. I wonder, so I'm going to put that spot.
Yeah, a question on the age of the Earth. Yeah, the age of the Earth is measured in several ways. Basically what we do, however, in trying to determine the age of the Earth, whichever way we use, we have a certain rate at which something occurs. For example, the rate at which a river may carry sediments and form a delta. We look at it every year and we see that the river can form a delta which is expanded, let's say, by a quarter of a mile every year. We look at the whole delta and we see that it is 10 miles long. Therefore, the river has been doing this. 10 miles divided by a quarter of a mile per year is going to give you 40 years. Now, that's the basic method that is used. Whether we're talking about the rate at which rivers can accumulate sediments to form a delta, whether we are talking about the rate at which certain materials decay radioactively, whether we are talking about the rate at which corals can grow, and then take the total growth and divide it by the rate, it's basically recognizing that certain things happen at a certain rate, trying to get a fix on the limits of that, and then taking the amount of material that we dividing it by the rate at which that process can produce. And so various methods will take us back from hundreds of thousands of years to millions of years, but in order to get back to the 4.5 billion years, then we have to use radioactivity. And radioactive measurements, both on Earth material, gives us things over 3 billion years old. When we look, however, at meteorites, and we look at rocks on the moon, then we see rocks that date anywhere from about 4.2 to about 4.6 billion years ago. So ultimately, in terms of looking at the solar system and saying the solar system formed 4.6 billion years ago, that is the oldest date that we get when we examine things from the solar system. Again, either meteorites or the moon. But it's based, those long dates are based on radioactivity.
We can call these good theories, and we know that good theories are supposed to
make a position. Can we say that this truth can predict that no life can ever come about on another planet? And if such a thing were to be discovered, how damaging would it be?
I would say one thing you've got compared to the very model you've got. I would predict that from our study of the question of origin of life, that a naturalistic origin of life is astronomically unlikely. Well, we know life exists on at least one planet, and my suggestion then is that is an indication that the model is wrong, and we have another alternative model, that is, God has intervened to do some of these things, and therefore it can happen. And then the question is, how often has God chosen to do it, to which he has given us no revelation to my knowledge. The other sheets that are not this whole, as far as I can tell, is a reference to the Gentiles in its context and not a reference to extraterrestrials. Perry has a remark in this area that might be of some interest, and that's the question of why haven't we been contacted by extraterrestrials?
Yes. When certain people back 10, 15 years ago were looking at the possibility that there might be other intelligent beings in the universe, they were operating on a set of assumptions that really made the existence of life pretty much the same in terms of probabilities as the existence of planets that were like the Earth. And basically, it was very posh to think that if there was another planet like the Earth, with the definition of an Earth-like planet that I gave, elsewhere in the galaxy, then, most likely, life would have evolved on it, and we would have beings that are as or more intelligent than we are. Therefore, there should be a lot of signals out there that these civilizations are sending out, both to try to contact other civilizations in the galaxy, and also simply because they too would have radio and television, and these signals escape from the planet and would be picked up by some other intelligent beings as well. The problem with that, we haven't found any. And a question that was asked by a great physicist by the name of Enrico Fermi towards the middle of this particular century was, where are they? We should have received signals by now. And he argued the very fact that we haven't had any contact whatsoever ever with other intelligences in the galaxy is an indication that they really aren't there. And so I would say from a naturalistic standpoint, as Bob has said, the probabilities of life arising by chance are so astronomically small that even if we have 4 billion Earth-like planets in the galaxy, that is peanut compared to the probability that life would have arisen. And so I would say, from natural means, I'm convinced that life would not have arisen. God may have put life on other planets, however. But the Proxima space probe goes into one of the moons of the solar system, let's say examines Titan, or examines one of the moons of Jupiter, and we find something that is alive. What does that do to our faith? To my mind, that says nothing to the historicity of the Bible. The Bible tells us what God has done here on earth. Finding life elsewhere says nothing to what Jesus has done here on this earth. It changes nothing in the history. God has not told us that this is the only place that he has created life. We know that there are other beings that exist, angels, demons, etc. And so what I would say is, although secularists will use life existing elsewhere in the solar system or the universe as proof that the Bible isn't true, we should not be taken in by that argument, because the historical material in the Bible is true whether there is life that exists elsewhere or not. And so we continually keep coming back to what the Bible says. And that would be my answer to life being found elsewhere.
The first question is concerning the fossil record and the things that have been deposited in Earth, and that it has taken so much time for those things to develop. In the Bible we read several places that so-and-so happened in order for such and such prophetic message be fulfilled. With regard to that, do you think it's feasible to believe that these enormous things that have been discovered by scientists were created by God as they are without spending that much of time, so that the prophetic message of knowledge being advanced and multiplied in these days be fulfilled. This is my one question. The other question is, I read in a small paper in Canada that in Maryland, where they have a test research center where they research about the movement of the universe in space, they were trying to find out where we would be in 100 years from now. And where, when they were calculating that, they missed a day. I don't understand that that's what it says. One Christian scientist, by referring to the Bible, helps them to find the 24-hour day that was missing by referring to, the, for instance, the 10 steps that the sun was asked to go back in order to give a proof for the king. Those were translated into 10 degrees, 4 minutes each, and they found some place where the sun was standing still for some time. Do you think this would support the concordistic view of Bible and time?
Okay, let me go back to the first question. Let me reword it and see if I've got it right. You're basically asking, we look in the fossil record and we see all these animals and things that lived and died and aren't around anymore. You're saying, what would have been God's purpose for having those animals around? Yeah, but what I want to say, all of those, do you think it is possible to think that all those things are created at one moment as they are, without necessarily going through the billions of years that they might take, so that the prophecy that knowledge would be multiplied be fulfilled, so that scientists would have something to look into to have advanced knowledge, just to have that prophecy fulfilled, as it says, like in the Bible, Jesus was betrayed by Judas so that prophecy may be fulfilled. Just to provide evidence for the prophecy.
Now, do you mean that the fossils were just created as fossils?
Yes.
And the animals never lived?
Yes. Everything created as it is, as the scientists find them now, so that the prophecy about knowledge be fulfilled and nothing more than that.
Okay.
Do you think it's feasible?
I think you get a problem if you say that there's features out there that we look at and say it looks like there's a living animal that's here and died. Because then you can say it looks like God is deceiving us by putting evidence out there that we, in studying, you know, there are things that we can be thrown off and take wrong and then go back later and realize we've made a mistake. But if there's a lot of things out there like complete skeletons of animals, fossilized in rocks and areas where hundreds of animals have died and their bones are piled together that we find and things like this in places out in Utah and such. We say these are things that the bones are not connected to any animal or anything that's ever lived in the past. God just put them there. Then what was his purpose in putting them there? I think I run into problems with that because you know, if God's putting things there from animals that never existed, then he's kind of deceiving us. And I don't see God as a deceptive God putting things out there to fool scientists or to fool people that go looking for fossil bones and things like that. The first question in there would be, well, why did he put these animals out there to exist and die before man was ever around? I think is a fair question. I can't say I have the exhaustive conclusion to it, but something that I've thought of is you're starting off with the Earth as this hot rock with a bunch of gases on it, no life whatsoever. Your final goal is to turn it into a stable temperature, nice atmosphere place where animals can live and man can live. That's your end goal. Very successfully. My analogy to that is a region of forest that has been burned out after a forest fire. Here you have an area that the earth is blackened, all life on it has been destroyed. How does that area turn itself back into a forest? It does it in stages. You get seeds which germinate only when a fire occurs, to come in and start germinating, hold down the soil so it doesn't wash away. You get grasses that come in, you get shrubs that come in, you get trash trees, very short-lived softwood trees like birch and aspen that take over an area. Then gradually the hardwoods then move in. You get a whole series of different life forms coming in to reclaim this bare area and turn it back into a good hardwood forest, which is kind of the final stage of forestation of land. That's sort of my analogy for what God is doing in starting from a bare rock with no life at all. First thing you've got to get going is you've got to get the atmosphere stable, to get your CO2 under control, your oxygen in there so that other things can happen. So you start with photosynthesis, you start with very simple cells, and you get those things going, change the atmosphere, start stabilizing things. Then you move to slightly more complex plants and animals that eat off of those plants to keep everything in balance. And you work through several cycles of these animals and plants until you finally get up to stable atmosphere, the right types of soil, and the full intent of animal complexity that you'd like to have for, you know, polishing off your creation. So that's the best analogy I've been able to come up with for why we have these dinosaurs out there that lived and died, why we have these whole huge fossilized forests of plants and ferns and various types of things that we don't see now. What was God doing? Was he just experimenting, and, oh, I didn't like this, I'll go on to something else? The best meaning I can put into that is he's developing the earth as a place that is best inhabited, most habitable by man. If the animals are too big and too ferocious, and too many of them, you know, giant dinosaurs running around eating people and things, that wouldn't be very good. So it's that type of balance, I think, that he has developed over time to get where we are now.
Okay, let's move on to the question quickly about head of giant.
I've done work on that. Several years ago, a fellow, a businessman in the Baltimore area named Charles Hill wrote a work, How to Live Like a King's Kid, which was kind of an upshot of an article that had spread almost all over the country in little papers here and there, in which he claimed that as a contractor for NASA, that he was told by someone in NASA, a Goddard Space Center at Greenbelt, Maryland, that their computer, which had been trying to follow the motions of the planets and the Earth and such, had been tracking it forward, backward in time, and they had spotted a missing day in time. So that's very interesting, and why don't you tell me what happened, etc. And they say, well, we found all but 40 minutes of a missing day back here, and maybe the day somewhere around Joshua time. And he shows them the passage about a whole day missing in the Bible, about the sun standing still and such. And then they go on and they find that there are 40 minutes missing in Hezekiah's time, and he points to the passage about the sun going back 10 degrees in the Bible, Ahaz. It's an exciting story, and would be very good apologetic for Christianity. The major problem, it appears, is it's a hoax. Whether Harold Hill invented the hoax, or whether somebody at NASA invented the hoax, I do not know. I was suspicious of it the first time I heard it, because I heard a similar story from a pastor that I was going to his church about 10 years earlier. It had the same narrative, not just the same, you know, these times were missing in the past, had the same narrative of a Bible believer talking to an unbeliever who had found these things and getting him to read through the Bible and come up to the Joshua time, and the guy said, well, that's not quite the right amount of time. He says read on, and he gets the Hezekiah time, and that works it out, etc. But the earlier story, which is one of Harry Rimmer's books from the 30s, which I heard from the pastor, had an astronomer from around the turn of the century at Yale, and a fellow Charles Totten, who was talking to him, was a believer. And so I was a little suspicious because the narrative were too similar in the two cases, and also because I couldn't figure out any way the computer could detect any missing days in time. The only thing I could think of that a computer might detect is being able to tell that eclipses of the sun were in the wrong place on Earth from where they ought to be. so the Earth had been rotating, it stopped sometime in between and it had shifted the location of the cliff somewhere. And I checked out, and we really do not have any detailed information about observations of eclipses before Joshua's time in order to be able to make a comparison between observed eclipses and calculated eclipses using a computer calculated back from the present time. So I was a little suspicious there anyway. So I got back and finally found Rimmer's book and found out that he says that this comes from a work by Charles Cotton called Joshua's Long Day in the Dial of Ahaz. So I scouted around, had a hard time finding that. It was not in print at that time. It was in print at the moment, or in print a few years ago. It was not in print at that time. I finally found a copy in a library and re-rocked it. And in that, there's no narrative. Cotton claims that he had found a missing day minus 40 minutes at Joshua's time, and the other 40 minutes to make a whole day at Hezekiah's time. But he explains how he found it. And that is this, that he had an almanac put out by the British Chronological Association called All Past Times. It gives you all the events that have occurred since the universe was created. But these guys, the British Chronological Association, Jabez Bunting Dimbleby was ahead of it, claimed that creation started on a Monday, and they give the exact day of the year and the year. But Cotton said, well, the Bible says it started on Sunday, because the seventh day was the rest, Sabbath. The first day was Sunday. It's missing a day. And then, although he hides it as mathematics, he obviously went and looked at the 10 degrees and the Dial of Ahaz passage, which probably means 10 steps on some kind of a large device rather than 10 degrees of a Babylonian 360-degree thing, and works out that the sun moves 10 degrees in 40 minutes, and so that's the 40 minutes, and then he throws the rest of it back in Joshua's time, and he gets it all to work out. But as far as I know, there's no way, with the known information at present, that will show whether those things went that way or not. I have no objection that Hezekiah, God caused a miracle at Hezekiah's time that involved the movement of a shadow. I do not know whether it's 10 degrees or not. That's an assumption. It's 10 steps is actually the term in Hebrew. And certainly the Bible says something about a striking event in Joshua's time, either the sun standing still or the sun stopping what it's doing. The term there in the Hebrew is actually sun be quiet. And whether be quiet means stop moving or whether be quiet means stop beating down on us like this, I'm not sure. And there have been different interpreters there. Biblically. It's something which I would like to be true, but the evidence doesn't look very good for it. And one of my main interests is Christian evidences, trying to help people think there's excellent evidence for Christianity. But one of the things that you need to do there is try to avoid using the Beit evidence. And the best I can tell is the Beit evidence. So I don't use it, and I would not recommend other people use it, although I've seen many tracts that have gone in that particular direction.
Okay. Yes, typically, the questions surround how do you explain Noah's Ark, and you know, there's 10,000 species of just a beetle. I mean, he must have been busy. And where did all of these things fit into the Ark? I don't know if this relates to our topic of discussion.
Sure. Okay, you know, you mentioned something like, you said something to me a while back when we were talking over here, and you said when you tell people that you think the Earth is 4.5 billion years old, you must have a lot of people get mad. Well, now I'm going to give you something else to get mad at. And that is the following. When I look at the terminology in Genesis 8-9 concerning the flood, I personally do not see anything there that necessitates it being a worldwide flood, but I do see enough there that necessitates the flood be wide enough to wipe out humanity. And in the locality in which it would have occurred, a local flood was nevertheless fairly widespread. Noah would be very interested, and God would be very interested in preserving the life that is around that particular region. And so basically what I see is Noah doing is protecting himself, protecting his family, protecting animals that would have difficulty getting along by themselves in that location. But the flood, not being so extensive, is to wipe out all humanity. Now, I know it says all, but we have to think, the whole world. Sorry, to wipe out all the animals in the whole world, but it does wipe out all of humanity. And so basically, I see a local flood, a great extent, but nevertheless local. One of the problems that I have with a universal flood comes with seeing on the earth today areas where there are kinds of animals that don't appear elsewhere. For example, having great marsupials as the most advanced form of mammals on Australia and New Zealand, but not seeing this elsewhere. And I have to ask the question, why is that? Why is it if all the animals, every last animal, came from Noah's Ark, how is it that only marsupials wound up crossing the water to get to Australia or New Zealand, and why aren't they elsewhere? And so basically, I feel that you've had more isolation of animals on the earth than you would have if indeed all the animals at one time were on Noah's Ark. And so what I have to say is a combination of the language, as a combination of what I see in terms of animal demographics, animal populations on earth, I have trouble accepting the flood as being universal. Now let me just end that by just saying one more thing. Is there any evidence that the flood may be local from the terminology that we find in Genesis? My answer is the following. When the mountains appeared, when we are told that Noah actually saw mountaintops from the ark, he sent out the dove. The dove comes back. He sends it out again, and the dove gets an olive leaf and brings it back, and Noah knows that the water is continuing to recede. We are told, however, that the dove comes back because there is no place for her to set her foot, for the whole land is covered with water. And yet we know mountaintops are visible. So earlier in the narrative, when it says the water covered all the high mountains or all the high hills, the whole land is covered with water, does it really mean the whole as we would think of the whole earth? Or really, is it the whole in terms of what Noah would be able to see by standing on the deck of the ark? And I feel there is warrant to understand the passage as a very wide local flood. Noah would not be able to see anything but water from where he is, and he preserves animals in that location, but yet in distant localities are animals that have not been affected by the flood. We know that after the flood, humanity tried to stay together by building the Tower of Babel, and basically God had to scatter them. I don't think it's unreasonable to feel that humanity tried to stay together before the flood and got wiped out, but nevertheless, you have distant animals that are existing on earth that have not gotten wiped out. So I don't feel that Noah is taking every last animal on the ark. He has taken the clean animals. He's taken animals that would have difficulty surviving in that region. Perhaps domestic animals, etc. Maybe one problem with that would be he does take the raven on board. But if you see the way ravens act, however, ravens gather around areas where there are humanity so they can pick up scraps from hunters, etc. So in some sense, even the ravens may be in some way dependent upon human beings, and that is the way I would explain what has occurred.
Yeah, I have a problem with the general scheme of things, one animal plant on another, one larger plant wiping out another plant. And I was told as I was growing up that was the scheme of things through the center. Was that the same scheme of thing inside the garden?
Not inside the garden. I see the garden as a special location where God is isolating one part of earth where the situation is different than what is normally found. I have no problem with animals having pounced on and eaten other animals before humans come on the scene. But when humans do come on the scene, when God creates man and woman, he puts them in an isolated location where things are really beautiful. And I don't see the Garden of Eden as a situation over the whole earth, but as a special location. In fact, we're told, here it is where the rivers are, and this is what is happening, and the rest of the world is different. And when humans sin, God drives them away and into the rest of the world where things are nastier, very nasty compared to what they are in the garden. And so what I see is that Garden of Eden is special. Now, perhaps I could just go on for a moment and answer the question, what about the fossil record that shows predators existing before humans. Isn't predation and isn't death a result of the fall? And if the fall took place, how can you have death if it's due to the fall? How can you have death millions of years before even the fall occurred, if we believe the fossil record? Legitimate question. I would give the following analogy to answer that question. We all know that individuals are saved, whether in the Old Testament or the New Testament, individuals are saved because of the work of Jesus Christ, who died on the cross to save humans from their sin. Jesus died, what we would say, around 30 A.D. Nevertheless, when we look at Abraham back about 2000 B.C., when we look at David back about 1000 B.C., and numerous Old Testament saints, it is clear that they are saved. It is clear from the scripture that all individuals are saved as a result of what Jesus has done. It appears that the death of Jesus is being applied retroactively to Old Testament saints for their salvation. To Abraham, to David, to other saints of the Old Testament. Can we not use the same argumentation concerning the fall? Yes, the fall may be the reason for all the destruction that we have seen on earth, both before and after the fall. And can we not have a parallel situation where the sin and the destruction as a result of the fall is applied retroactively before it even occurred, in the same way that we would take the just death of Jesus and apply it for purposes of salvation retroactively before Jesus actually died?
And carries it out. So the possibility, now that's very speculative, okay? But so that's an alternative suggestion, and we just don't have enough information to know which of those two or whether some other suggestion might really be it. One of the remarks, which I thought of earlier, when Perry was suggesting the possibility that Eden was a special place and that things were better there, there's a remark in regard to the end of the age, probably the millennium, which pictures that the mountain around the Lord's house, be very different than it is now, will be a very special place. They will not hurt and destroy anywhere on my holy mountain, says God. And perhaps the child playing around the hole with a snake, etc., applies to that area during that period. I don't know. So there could be some interest there to see the possibility that the events of the millennium resemble the Eden situation to some extent, and you're moving back toward, now it's moving toward the new heavens and the new earth. Notice a lot of speculation there. We're trying to deal with questions that we can ask, but God didn't give a definite revelation on.
Here the interpretation that we have seen and heard spoke about life starting on a simple plane and then building the most complex. The problem I had is with the natural law, the law of thermodynamics, which talks about this deterioration of life. Do you have a problem with that?
Yeah, I have a problem with that. A way of stating what we said a few things about already, the level of information in existing things, that can be expressed in information theory in terms of what we call entropy. And entropy tends to, disorder tends to increase by the second law of thermodynamics, whether it be chemical entropy or information entropy. I think probably the question of origin of life is more a question of information entropy than chemical entropy. We do know that living systems actually decrease the entropy within themselves, that is, they increase the order within themselves, though when you hook them in with a system that they're being their energy from, they increase the disorder in the whole system, okay? So a living thing is in fact designed to violate the second principle, the second law of thermodynamics within itself at the expense of increasing the disorder around it. A refrigerator works that way, by the way. A refrigerator does something very strange. It takes the temperature of a little area and it moves it away from equilibrium. You have a refrigerator and you turn it off, the temperature inside begins to move towards the temperature outside until they're even. It stops, okay? But the refrigerator is designed to move the temperature inside cooler away from the outside temperature, but it does that at the expense of heating up the outside. That's what the little radiator on the back side is. And that's why it's a waste of time to set a air conditioner in your room with both the outside part and the inside part in your room. You just heat up the room. You gotta stick the outside part out your window so it can heat up the outside while the inside part is cooling the inside. So, living systems do that thing. They, in that sense, locally violate into the second law of thermodynamics. That is, they increase the order within themselves, but they do it at the expense of decreasing the order outside. So, but that is a good problem for getting life to start by itself. Life, a design system, can fight that. But things naturally don't build themselves in that system. So that's how I would see it, an information version of entropy rather than of the entropy principle of the second law, rather than a chemistry version of the second law.
Okay. Now, I have a question with regard to the Garden of Eden. A few years ago, somebody had mentioned to me that in the Biblical Archaeological Review, they found the Garden of Eden or something like that. And I never looked it up. I never looked into it. But what is the story on that? Have they located the thing? Do they know where they think it might be? Or has been? Is it desert? Is it overgrown? Or what?
Every few years, somebody thinks they've found it.
Yeah.
The last one I've heard, which may not correlate with this one at all, is that when they looked at that, they think it might probably be underwater in the Persian Gulf. That if you look in that area, it's fairly shallow, and one guy who is looking at the, you know, the pictures that they construct of what the floor of the Persian Gulf looks like, he felt he found two other river valleys in there. Remember, Tigris and Euphrates, and then two other ones that they can't really locate. So that's where people go off when they're trying to find where the two other ones. This guy thought he had found two other river valleys coming into, you know, that are now submerged under the Persian Gulf, and said, aha, there's the four rivers that are where Eden was. That's the kind of level of speculation that's being done on it, and there's, you know, total speculation just from looking at maps is basically what people are doing.
I'm hoping to say, as far as what the Bible has to say about God placing angels or something to guard the way so that no one could get in at the same time. Have you ever heard of that?
Yeah. That's certain.
My inclination would be he guards it until it's no longer a garden that anyone would want to get in. But the purpose of guarding it, obviously, is to protect the tree of life. Okay. Now, we don't know. On a regional flood view here, whether the Garden of Eden would have been within the range of that flood, but if it was, that would have wiped out the tree, and then there'd be no need to guard it after that. So it presumably would have obliterated any obvious traces to the garden, although it might be able to trace things like river valleys to do the thing. So other possibilities, if it's some special place, God can always remove it and take it back. He's going to send the New Jerusalem down. He could have presumably pulled the Garden of Eden away.
That's perspective. Okay. Hello? Hi. Oh, well, the question is, this brings up the question of macro and micro evolution, and is it possible that we know this time there are far fewer species than exist today, various things, and even though life might start, start spontaneously, that life can change? And so that is as part of an answer to that kind of question. And the second thing related to it is, how do you think marsupials did wind up in Australia?
The first question, how fast does life change? A lot of the, we have to, in order to answer that question, it'd be nice to know how much time there has been between ourselves and Noah. Certainly if you take the genealogies that are given in Genesis 5 and 11 and add up the years, then you're going to have Noah going back 2,000 years as kind of a minimum age. If you believe that there are gaps in the genealogy, it has been argued all the way back in 1890 that there are gaps in the genealogies, and really we can't use them for the antiquity of man, then man may be tens of thousands to hundreds of thousands of years old. Even if we're talking about a few hundred thousand years, it does not appear that species or animals can change that quickly, such that we would have, let's say, some archetype kind of beetles that would be on the ark and later give rise to all sorts of other kinds of beetles that we see now. It appears that change in speciation simply cannot happen that quickly. Now, in terms of your second question, which I forgot.
Marsupials are...
marsupials. Yes, I would explain that. I would explain a lot of the differentiation that has happened in terms of various living systems on isolated areas as continental drifts. At one time, Australia or Australia and New Zealand and Southeast Asia were part of one unit. And that has split up over the course of a couple hundred million years. And during that time, you've had isolation, and with an isolated area, over the course of a few million years, then you can get differences that can occur in animals and plants.
Expanse of
time, right. Now, with your work at Denton, you may want to say something along those lines. So,
the rate at which a new species forms is roughly figured to be in the thousands of years, 1,000 to 10,000 or more. Mm-hmm. So, to get that much diversity in beetles, that's just given a number of biologists to figure out what time scale you're talking.
So one new species every 8,000 years, perhaps.
Yeah, and that'd be pushing it.
Yeah, so if you take a minimum age of let's say, a few thousand years of Noah, you're only getting a handful of different species.
I have a question concerning the reliability of carbon dating. I heard a comment, I think it's from Whitman and Morris, that the canopy before the flood has messed up carbon dating so that it's useless.
It is common in younger circles, particularly, to argue that a canopy does lots of things, accounts for longevity of mankind in antiquity, as you can guess, protects from ultraviolet, protects from copper grade, particularly, which would produce carbon 14, etc. The evidence for a canopy is extremely scanty. The passage of the waters above the firmament in Genesis is really it. And that would be adequate, I suppose. You just say it's a pen of some sort. And then various younger creationists have worked out a scheme of that sort. However, there's a passage in Psalm 148 that's a rather serious problem. And that is a Psalm of David, in which he speaks of the waters that are above the heavens, praising God, etc. It sounds like they're still there at David's time. I did my STM thesis in the Old Testament on the biblical teaching on the firmament. I was interested in what the Bible taught in that area. And I came to the conclusion that the biblical teaching regarding the firmament is what we call the atmosphere. But that the water above the firmament, the water above the heavens in Genesis, is a mistranslation of the preposition above there. It appears that it's saying that it is water that is supported by the atmosphere, water that is supported by the heavens, is one of the names for atmosphere. And we're talking about clouds, which are floating in the sky, so to speak. And the way you can see this was looking at how Hebrew handles prepositions with non-solid objects. For instance, when the Bible talks about a leaf blowing, it says that leaf is carried before the wind, in front of the wind. Now, if you press that literally, it means all the wind is behind it and none of the wind is in front of it. But that's not what the word means. He means the wind is pushing that along. And there's a remark in Job about clouds, about water being held up by the cloud under them, and the cloud don't rip under them. And what it is, obviously, is the waters, the clouds are holding water. So the picture here I would suggest is that in that passage in Genesis, where we have the separation of two kinds of water, we're talking about surface water and atmospheric water, we would see in the form of clouds, and that David is talking about the same thing there. So that means really that the alleged biblical evidence for a canopy evaporates at that point. It already is in trouble because it's supposed to fall into the flood. But in fact, there are only two references. The other reference is long after the flood, and doesn't seem to be retrospective that it was back that way. It seems to be saying it is that way. I think it's just talking about clouds for the time. If there wasn't a canopy then, that means you have to explain longevity some other way. The Bible doesn't tell us what other way to explain it, but a not unreasonable possibility would be man's sinfulness has messed up things enough that it has cut his lifespan down one way or another. And just what all those ways are, I don't know, but we're finding it all for you. May have messed up the environment and is fouling up with the lifespan, and maybe even that's what they've gotten older.
As far as Psalm 14, Psalm 14 David thought he was determine the accuracy about plus or minus 1% out to about 12,000 years. At the very maximum, where modern techniques can be pushed out to about 40,000 years, depending on it's getting a plus or minus 25-30% error every time. But 40,000 is really the maximum for carbon 14. And carbon 14 is nice because you can use it for what we call organic materials, things that were alive, things that are made, fuels, etc., that might be made by human beings, cloth, etc. But beyond 40,000 years, that's it. That's the maximum.
In Genesis says that the oldest man is 969 years old. And I'm 28. You know, we assume that the 1 year in the days of Adam, the same expansion as the 365 days.
I tend to think so. I tend to think that humans did live longer, but as Bob said, the cumulative effects of sin are really taking their toll on the human race as they go on. And we talk about pollution, certainly immoral activity among human beings has shortened the lifespan. There are a number of things there, and I think what we're finding is that human beings are becoming not only weakened spiritually, they're also becoming weakened physically and simply not living as long, nor are they able to have children as a late of age as they were initially. And both of those things, the longevity of the human being, and how old one is before one can have children, or how old one can be and still have children, I should say, I think are good signs as how robust the human race really is. And we find that decreasing rather quickly as sin keeps piling up upon sin in the human race.
Yeah, but you feel as a man would be the same.
I feel as the same, right. Yes. Yeah, days of years, basically, it says. And the days of so-and-so were so many years. And then you see that changing as we get closer and closer to people that we can relate more to, like Abraham, etc., we can relate to a definite culture. I see no reason to think there are different kinds of years that are being spoken of when we talk about people who live 900 years as opposed to people who only live 100 some years.
That's because God put a top limit to humanity, 120 years. And we know that the maximum is 120.
Well, so 120 years, he says, I will give human beings 120 years basically before I wipe them out. And so what he's saying is, from the time he makes that statement in Genesis chapter 6, it'll be 120 years until the flood comes. And so I see it as giving humankind 120 years to repent before he finally comes in judgment. And through that time, he's preaching through Noah, but human beings will be around for another 120 years before the flood comes and wipes them out. I personally don't see that as meaning that human beings will only live 120 years at maximum. Although people aren't even approaching that today. I mean, as the psalmist says, we're lucky to get to 80 years. We see somebody 80 years old today, you think that they live a pretty good life.
You certainly have people who live beyond 120 years of life after that statement is made in Abraham's production. Another thing that might be of some interest is if you say, well, maybe these years are very short years, and therefore we'll say they're months or something like that. So you get reasonable length of lifespans, we think today. What you find out is you have them bearing children at unreasonably early ages. So I think you have to say that earlier man had a definition for a year that was a recurrence of seasons. And we know now that the recurrence of seasons has to do with the earth going around the sun once. And there's been no mechanism that would have changed that drastically over the history of the solar system. So there's no reason why you convert